Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, new federal immigration data shows Orange County Jail has the longest average detention stays of any immigration detention facility in New York. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar will help us break down what the numbers reveal and how increased immigration enforcement and New York's new Local Cops, Local Crimes Act could affect local communities. The Beach Boys won't be performing at Bethel Woods' 20th anniversary celebration tomorrow, but the show must go on with a new headliner, free admission, and a full day of music, family activities, and fireworks. One of New York's most dangerous invasive plants can cause severe burns just from skin contact. Coming up, we'll learn how to identify giant hogweed. Plus, Lake Wallenpaupack turns 100 and a one-woman show opening at Franklin Stage Company this weekend after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump says he's placing a condition on Washington's new nuclear agreement with Saudi Arabia. In a post on social media, he says the deal is subject to Saudi Arabia normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel by joining the Abraham Accords signed in 2020. The Saudi nuclear agreement allows the U.S. to build and run nuclear energy plants in the kingdom. The president's post also says the deal doesn't allow for the enrichment of uranium. Daniel Ben-Ayim is with the Middle East Institute, and he was a deputy assistant secretary of state in the Biden administration.
I think that the actual terms of this deal, at least as they've been reported, are kind of very unique, in which a U.S. company might be operating inside Saudi Arabia without actually sharing sensitive nuclear technology. Those seem like terms that other countries wouldn't particularly want. But I think it is a real concern that other countries will say this is the new baseline and we can follow it. And it will require a lot of very careful and assertive diplomacy by the United States to make sure that this doesn't become the new normal for every country in the region, which I don't think would be in our interest.
That's Daniel Ben-Ayim speaking to Morning Edition. House Republicans are referring former special counsel Jack Smith to the Justice Department for possible prosecution. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports the lawmakers are citing statements Smith made under oath to Congress last year.
House Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, is urging the DOJ to investigate Jack Smith over the former prosecutor's testimony about his effort to gather phone records of GOP lawmakers. Jordan says Smith seems to have made false statements in a deposition last December. Smith led two criminal investigations of President Donald Trump, including an effort to charge Trump for interfering in the 2020 election. His team gathered records of certain lawmakers as part of that probe. Smith's lawyer says he gave candid testimony to the House about his work as special counsel, and he says the new referral is an effort to weaponize the justice system against a longtime civil servant. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio held direct talks with his Russian counterpart on the sidelines of a minister's summit in the Philippines today. NPR's Charles Maines reports their conversation focused heavily on Russia's war in Ukraine.
The meeting between Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov lasted just over half an hour. Ahead of it, Rubio said the U.S. remained open to playing a role in ending the conflict between Russia and Ukraine if, Rubio added, the opportunity presented itself. A Russian Foreign Ministry readout said Lavrov had informed Rubio of the real situation on the battlefield. Russia insists its forces are steadily advancing, that despite Western intelligence that shows minimal Russian gains coming with heavy losses. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The man who pleaded guilty to killing Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark, will be sentenced today. Vance Belter also confessed to shooting a state senator and his wife. A man in Florida is suing OpenAI, alleging ChatGPT gave him dangerous medical advice during a health crisis. NPR's Shannon Bond reports the lawsuit comes as AI companies are promoting their chatbots as resources for health.
Scott Winters says he suffered a near-fatal pulmonary embolism last year after turning to ChatGPT about his health problems. He says the chatbot discouraged him from seeking medical care for his symptoms and gave him dangerous recommendations, including about taking prescription drugs. The lawsuit filed in California state court alleges OpenAI safeguards meant to urge people to seek professional advice failed Winters. OpenAI says in a statement that ChatGPT should not be used as a substitute for medical care, diagnosis, diagnosis or treatment. Winters is seeking damages and asking the court to order OpenAI to strengthen its guardrails around medical conversations. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
The European Union is fining Google $1 billion for breaking digital antitrust regulations. The EU says Google set up its search engine and Google Play to favor its own services over competitors. Cases of the measles have hit their highest level in the U.S. since the early 90s, according to Johns Hopkins University. Its tracker has recorded 2,295 reported cases this year. The Senate is still considering the nomination of Dr. Erica Schwartz as CDC director. I'm Kristen Wright. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New federal data shows that Orange County Jail leads New York in having the longest length of a stay compared to any other detention facility in the state. The jail has served as an immigration detention facility since 2008. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement released its detention data for 2026 to date earlier this month. Here to help us unpack the numbers is Radio Catskills reporter Kimberly Izar. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about this latest information on federal immigration as it relates to New York and Orange County Jail?
Yeah, so the Trump administration, ICE, released new federal data earlier this month. They kind of released detention numbers each year, but this is kind of like their midway point. And it shows a ton of information, but I want to talk a little bit about the average length of stay. So ICE has five detention facilities across the state, including Orange County Jail in Goshen, New York. Of those five facilities, Orange County Jail has the longest average length of stay of ICE detainees, according to this new federal data. The average amount of time that an individual spends in ICE detention in Orange County is actually 47 days, so roughly about a month and a half. And kind of how that compares to other detention facilities across the state is, in short, it varies. For example, in Batavia, in Buffalo, the average length, I think, is like 38 days. And then if you travel further south to Nassau County and Long Island, the average length of stay is like 2 days. So it's a really big range and gap. And that kind of tracks with other national trends in other states. It really depends on kind of physically where you are. It could be, you know, further north or west of the state. And then if you travel just maybe an hour or two further south, and it can change pretty dramatically.
What does prolonged immigration detention mean for those who are held? Are there health impacts, other impacts?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence shows that the longer person stays in immigration detention, the more likely they are to, you know, suffer from negative health risks, whether that's mental health issues. An individual can also suffer from more prolonged PTSD symptoms. I'll say that ICE, the federal government, doesn't really release health information on, you know, individuals who are detained by ICE, except when someone dies in ICE custody. So we don't really have that micro or macro level data. But what we do know, even just anecdotally from talking to individuals, is that there is a psychological impact. The longer a person stays in an immigration detention facility, the longer they don't know what the next step is going to be, the less access they might have to primary care, follow-up care, access to prescription or other care services. I'll also note that, like, there's also this impact on who is being most affected by these detentions, right? Like, we know that Black and Latino communities are more likely to be stopped by ICE, to be detained by ICE, to be deported. And I was looking at some of the numbers from even just the beginning of the Trump administration, the first half of 2025, and it's like 9 out of 10 people who are arrested by ICE is Latino. And so there's also this long, this longer impact on people of POC communities in terms of the impact that might have.
If you were listening to NPR in the last day, there was a report about a person held in ICE detention in Georgia with disability and how some members of Congress are raising concerns about conditions in immigration detention centers for people with disabilities as well. This particular individual was a double amputee who said he had to crawl across filthy bathroom floors in order to shower.
Yeah, and also something to note is that we're talking like specifically about the average length of stay in Orange County Jail, but it's not like someone is detained at the jail and then that's it. Like there are things that happen after. For example, an individual can be deported, and then there's long impacts to a family, for example, because let's say a family member is no longer with them in the United States. An individual can also be transported to another facility. So something that we often hear from immigration attorneys is that after someone leaves New York State, they go to kind of those larger detention facilities in the South, so like in Louisiana or Texas. Or let's say in the case that an individual is released from ICE custody, they then have to navigate the whole process of potentially not being at work, reconnecting with their family. There's so much that goes on after that happens.
Immigration arrests are up, a record high of 43,138 people arrested in June. The ICE agency is also hiring rapidly as well. It says it's hired more than 12,000 officers in less than a year, with some folks questioning the vetting process. And we've talked before about how the Trump administration is ramping up these operations, being a little bit more quiet about it in right. some ways. How have local officials and advocates reacted to these latest immigration operations?
I think there's like a level of frustration and then also confusion at the same time, because as you mentioned, ICE is kind of moving much more quietly. We're not seeing these very public, large-scale immigration raids that we were seeing in Minnesota and other
surges.
Surges, yes.
They were being very, very vocal and very prominent about these.
Absolutely. Now we're seeing that immigration agencies are moving much more quietly. All that to say, like, immigration arrests, as you just described, are very much still happening across the country and then also in New York and Pennsylvania. I reached out to ICE just to inquire more about the data, similar to other media requests that we've put with ICE. We haven't heard back from them. I also reached out to the Orange County Sheriff's Office to kind of understand why this length of stay is so much longer here than compared to the rest of the state, and also didn't hear back. But I'll also, if we have a little bit of time, just talk a little bit about what we're seeing in Orange County more broadly with the Newburgh proposed warehouse. So earlier, actually a couple of weeks ago, we found out that the federal government leased this Newburgh warehouse. We've talked about it on the show quite a bit. And we're trying to find answers on what this warehouse will be used for, if it's actually going to be used for an ICE detention facility or other, immigration purposes. And in terms of what local officials have said, people are demanding answers. Just yesterday, Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand sent a letter to DHS Secretary Mullen and said that they want to know more information because folks are kind of just left out in the dark. Town supervisors have also not been receiving any information from DHS. Same with county legislators. We've been in contact with Orange County legislator Genesis Ramos, who said that the county has not received any information from the federal government. They've also been pushing back on any potential ICE detention facility in Orange County. They just passed a resolution actually just yesterday, and that goes to the full legislature, I believe, in August.
And again, the federal contract records and reports show that a warehouse in the town of Newburgh in Orange County was leased, but there's little more, not much more known than that.
Yeah, we really know is that the federal government leased this $35 million kind of like vague lease to this Texas-based contractor by the name of Leverage Enterprises. It's a 15-year lease, but we don't have the specifics on like what the lease will do. We know that it will store quote-unquote detainee vans and buses. They had very specific requirements, but for the most part, we're still looking for answers.
And all of this is happening as New York just passed the Local Cops, Local Crimes Act.
Right.
Let's remind folks what that is and what you've heard about how local agencies may or may not cooperate.
Yeah, so the Local Cops, Local Crimes Act was a state law that was passed in the state budget earlier this year from New York Governor Kathy Hochul. And what the act says is that, local law agencies are prohibited from entering those 287G agreements. Those agreements essentially outline that local law agencies cannot cooperate. It pretty much limits cooperation with federal immigration agencies, and that local corrections facilities can't hold ICE detainees. So as we've been talking about, Orange County Jail has been this immigration detention facility since 2008. That contract really can be a thing post August 25th. I have reached out to the Orange County Sheriff's Office to kind of just learn more about the transition. I'm still waiting on a response on what that will look like. We're also hearing kind of anecdotally from organizers and advocates that they're hearing that local law enforcement agencies have said that they're not going to comply with this new state law that also tracks with other reporting that we've been seeing in the state. So right now we're kind of just waiting for more answers from local and county agencies. And, you know, August 25th is just around the corner.
Not too far away. Kimberly Izar, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
In other news, Bethel Woods Center for the Arts is moving ahead with its 20th anniversary celebration despite a last-minute change in the lineup. The Beach Boys were to be the main attraction, but they've postponed all of their upcoming performances, including Friday's scheduled concert at Bethel Woods. In response, Bethel Woods has made the event free to attend, with a new 60s act stepping in as the headliner. Jason Dole spoke with Brid Van Horn from Bethel Woods about the changes shortly after they were announced yesterday.
So on Friday, July 24th, we have our Bethel Woods 20th anniversary celebration, which is a day full of activities, music, fireworks, giveaways, free museum entry, all the fun stuff. And, the Beach Boys were slated as our headliner, but things happen and life happens, and they have had to postpone their upcoming performances, which includes our performance on Friday. But not to worry, we will still have music all day. And we'll have a headlining set by Herman's Hermits starring Peter Noon.
Peter Noon, of course, from Herman's Hermits. Also, people might know he's a host of Something Good, his weekly program on Sirius XM's 60s Gold. But there's a lot more going on besides just the music as well, right? I mean, the celebration's still happening, right?
Yes, the celebration is absolutely happening. And I'm so happy to say that it's actually free for anybody who would like to join us. The gates will open at 2:00. All the fun will start at 2:15, right on the dot, with a performance by Jake Nelson. And the fun will happen for the rest of the day up until about 9:15, when we'll have fireworks as a grand finale. But we'll have free museum admission if you want to check out the museum at Bethel Woods and study up on all things 60s and all things 1969 Woodstock Festival. We'll have giveaways with lots of fun items. We'll have, crafting activities, lots of family-friendly things going on. And we also have $20 camping that we're offering as well for car and tent camping if anyone wants to stay the night. And all of this will be happening on our upper campus We'll have two different stages. We'll have the Horizon stage, and we'll also have our community stage. And on the Horizon stage, we'll have performances by Remember Jones, the Chris Rabe Band, and like I said, Jake Nelson.
Okay, so there's a lot of music going on Friday.
There's a lot of music going on. And we'll also have some really special performances by some of our really local Bethel Woods talent, like our Rock Camp Ambassador Band, who actually learned how to play their instruments right here at Bethel Woods, which is very special.
People had been buying tickets for this event. It's now a free event. This is actually, historically speaking, a familiar situation for the site of Bethel Woods. But
it is.
What could you tell ticket holders about any kind of refund process, anything like that? How would that work?
Yeah.
What should they do?
So if you have a ticket to Friday's activities and show and celebration, not to worry. Refunds will be coming your way, but you are more than welcome to still join us for all of the fun. And refunds will be processed automatically and taken care of. If you have premium parking that you paid for, that will also be refunded into your account. And if you want to repurchase premium parking, you're more than welcome to, but all of those refunds will be processed automatically.
And I know you ran down like various activities you got going on and lots of music.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, are there any special exhibits or activities or anniversary connected things or moments that people should be looking out for?
Ooh, that is a really good question. So at the Museum of Bethel Woods, if you want to take a visit over to the museum building and use that free museum admission on the day of, it's great to learn about the history of Woodstock and the historic site of Bethel Woods, and then come out of the museum and go over to the celebration and see where Bethel Woods has evolved into in the past 20 years and how it's evolved since the Woodstock Festival. And we'll be giving away lots of fun items that are branded with 20th anniversary iconography. And so you'll have some free Bethel Woods swag if you're one of the first few hundred people to enter the celebration.
I guess Bethel Woods is holding a celebration, you know, in part because it's not just about what Bethel Woods does at Bethel Woods, but it's also about the communities within which it operates. This seems like an opportunity to really engage a community, you know, for all the support that folks have been showing over the past 20 years. Is that part of the angle here?
Oh, my gosh, of course. And, you know, with today and the last-minute schedule change of the Beach Boys no longer being able to join us for our day of celebration, we're so grateful to everyone who has shown us love and support and still wants to come out and spend the day with us and celebrate our birthday alongside us. And so much of what we do is for the community, and we love seeing everybody come out, the joy on their faces, everyone's dancing and singing, and we're hoping that Friday will be just that.
Just a couple more logistical questions. With this change in the lineup, are there any changes or updates that folks should know about in terms of parking, entry, schedule, or timing, any of that, when they should arrive, things like that?
Yeah, great question. So everything was scheduled as 2 p.m. Prior to all these changes happening, and showtime still starts at 2 p.m. So there'll be a whole day of activities. Everything starts at 2. Float in when you'd like to. There will be things going on all day. Like I said, lots of different music, lots of different activities, and things going on all around Upper Campus.
So people can come out even earlier, like before 2 o'clock, or they can come out later as they like. It's really flexible.
Absolutely. It is flexible. Yeah. You know, if you have summer Fridays, get out of work when you can, come join us. Whatever fits with your schedule. We will be open from 2 to headlining Showtime with Herman's Hermits starring Peter Noon.
All right. Well, Bryn Van Horn, Bethelwood Center for the Arts, thank you for taking the time on what is very much a busy day for you. And I wish you all the best at the celebration itself.
Thank you so much, Jason. Pleasure to chat with you.
We'll take a break and back with more Radio Catskill after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
On this Old House Radio Hour, the great dishwasher debate is finally settled. Are you loading yours the right way?
The corners of your dishwasher are where it's going to struggle to provide a lot of cleaning action. If you have dirty items, you definitely don't want to be placing them at the corners.
Plus, author Colson Whitehead revisits a family home that tells more than a century of Black history. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life.
I just think we're opening a whole can of worms here that we don't want to be.
To better understand testosterone and its effects, I and the staff of the radio show get our testosterone levels checked to see who has the most.
For the men, I think it'll be a big deal. You'll know when you're talking to each other who beat you. I think it'll change everything.
This whole thing is going to lead to heartbreak.
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation wants to recruit pheasant hunters to promote preservation. New York Public News Network's Sophia Imbriaco has more.
Last month, the New York DEC released a strategic plan that, over the next decade, would shift state efforts away from trying to restore wild pheasant habitat and toward recruiting hunters. Jackie Lendrum, director of the state's Division of Fish and Wildlife, explains the DEC is aiming to promote a conservation ethic through hunting.
Once folks are outside and they're experiencing the great outdoors that we have here in New York State and the wildlife, the habitats, these great state lands, that then they value that, right? If they're out there, they're experiencing it, they value it, they'll work to protect it.
Lendrum says many people getting into hunting are interested in connecting with where their food comes from.
One of the growing populations of new hunters that we're seeing are actually women in their mid to early 30s. And what you're seeing is that people really want to be involved and know where their food is coming from, right? And so there is nothing more natural or more organic than meat that you harvest yourself.
Since the early 20th century, pheasants have been a favorite of small game hunters in New York, and hunting them is an accessible way to get into the sport. However, New York's wild pheasant populations are at an all-time low, as New York DEC biologist and small game unit leader Joshua Stiller explains. This is largely due to habitat loss.
We had a lot of areas of New York that the landscape has just changed significantly. We've lost grasslands. We've lost the habitat that would otherwise support pheasants in New York State.
As pheasant hunting remains popular, the state raises and releases over 30,000 pheasants annually on lands open to the public for hunting. The new pheasant stocking plan would increase the number of stocking locations near major population centers and promote awareness of public pheasant hunting opportunities. The state's DEC is accepting comments on the plan through July 25th. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sophia Imbriaco.
And giant hogweed is one of New York's most dangerous invasive plants. Its sap can cause severe burns and even permanent scarring when exposed to sunlight. As the growing season continues, state officials are reminding people to learn how to identify the plant, avoid contact, and report sightings. Joining us now is Daniel Waldhorn of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Lands and Forests, where he specializes in invasive species. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
What exactly is giant hogweed, and why is it considered one of the most dangerous invasive plants in New York?
So giant hogweed is a very large plant in the carrot family. It can grow about 8 to 15 feet tall and has a flower that's about 2 to 2.5 feet wide. And its sap contains a chemical that when it's absorbed into your skin in combination with sunlight, very severe rashes and chemical burns. Definitely a good thing to learn how to identify and learn to avoid. And if you see any, definitely reach out to us and we can be of assistance.
And you mentioned the injuries it can cause. Why does sunlight make the reaction so much worse?
So the chemical actually binds to your DNA in the nucleus of your cell. And when sunlight hits that chemical, it agitates it. And that physically damages your cell, causing them to die. So it causes severe blistering and your skin can slough off. So that's why, you know, if you do get exposed to giant hogweed and some of its relatives, you know, it's a very good idea to wash off and go indoors, just because it is a sort of a two-part process to get that burn. So even if you are exposed, going indoors and avoiding direct sunlight can help you avoid a nasty rash.
And when should someone seek medical attention if they've touched giant hogweed and have a reaction?
I think if you have a reaction, it's probably a good idea to go see a doctor, just to make sure it doesn't turn into anything worse.
Now,
or it could be something else, you know.
Right. Now, giant hogweed resembles, you know, other large plants that people might see along roadsides or in fields. And I don't want to say it's pretty, but, you know, the top part is white and, you know, not unattractive, I suppose. But what are the key characteristics people should look for to identify it correctly?
Sure. So, yeah, the carrot family is often called the umbellifer family because the flowers resemble umbrellas. So it's sort of a large umbrella-shaped flower sitting at the top of the plant, and then usually a couple smaller sort of satellite flowers around that big main one. And then it has very large leaves with sort of serrated edges and a very thick stem that has dark purple blotches and coarse white hairs on it. So it's pretty identifiable. There are some other species that share some of those features, but not all of them.
And
generally speaking,
I was going to say, what are some of those native plants or harmless lookalikes that people commonly mistake for giant hogweed?
Sure. So right now, elderberry is blooming across the state, and that's something that, while not technically an umbel, it looks a lot like an umbel. And so people will see these sort of large white flowers about 8 to 10 feet tall in a hedgerow and call that in. Queen Anne's lace looks a lot like giant hogweed, but is much, much smaller and is a harmless plant. And then, you know, there are other carrot family plants, angelica, cow parsnip, wild parsnip. And wild parsnip is actually a good one to look out for because it's an invasive plant. And it can cause a similar burn to hogweed. And then that one grows a lot smaller and has yellow flowers, but it has that same characteristic umbrella-shaped flower.
Where is giant hogweed most commonly found, and are there particular habitats where people should be especially alert?
Sure. So it's most commonly found in New York State, in the central and western portion of the state, and is often found in creeks, along farm fields and roads. The seeds are fairly big, so it doesn't usually spread very far on its own. So usually if it's growing alongside of a creek, it will drop into the seeds will drop into the creek and be transported along that way, or it's usually transported by farm equipment or mowing equipment along roadsides.
Is giant hogweed spreading into new areas, or has DEC seen any changes in where it's being reported in recent years?
Generally, I'd say it's pretty consistent, where there, you know, some creeks in western New York are heavily infested, and there's some, you know, movement along those creek corridors. But yeah, you know, generally speaking, you know, we have an information line, for people to report, infestations or suspected infestations to us, so we can keep track of that and then send sites out to some partner agencies that we work with to control the plants.
And if someone discovers giant hogweed on their property, should they try to remove it, or is it better to call for assistance?
I would recommend calling us for assistance no matter what. You know, some people might like to do the control themselves, but we can help provide you with the best information to do that effectively and safely. So, yeah, I would definitely encourage people, if you think you have giant hogweed or you want more information, you can reach our information line at 845-256-3111. And you can also email pictures of any suspected hogweed plants you find to ghogweed@dec.ny.gov.
It has its own email, giant hogweed.
Yep, exactly.
It's that big. What are the most effective methods for controlling it, and why can it take multiple years to completely eliminate an infestation?
Sure. So, there are kind of two methods that we recommend, one of which is to hold a shovel at the base of the plant at about a 45-degree angle and then step through the taproot about an inch below the soil level to sever that taproot, and that will kill the plant and so it can't regrow. And then we usually recommend sort of just lofting that cut and up somewhere so it doesn't touch the ground and can't reroot itself. But, you know, it is a dangerous plant, and when you cut it, you increase the chance of being exposed to that sap. So, you know, another great way to control it is just to spray some herbicide on the leaves. And then that way you can stand, you know, a couple feet away from it without actually physically touching the plant. And that herbicide should take effect and kill the plant within a couple weeks. And what was your second question of that? I forget.
Why can it take multiple years to completely get rid of it?
Sure. So often when a plant goes to seed, some of those seeds will germinate the first year. Some of those seeds will germinate the second, third, and fourth, and so on, just to sort of hedge its bets against a particularly unsuitable climate one year. So often the seeds will keep germinating for about 5 to 9 years. And each individual plant can produce 20,000 seeds. Each year we'll visit a site and control the plants that are there. But they'll often, you know, in subsequent years, additional seeds will be germinating in the seed bank there in the soil. So we have to continue to visit to make sure none of those plants grow and, you know, flower and set seed and reproduce.
Beyond giant hogweed, are there other invasive plants New Yorkers should keep an eye out for this summer?
Sure. You know, the wild parsnip that I mentioned is a good one, just because it's a little less conspicuous than hogweed, but it can cause a serious rash. So sometimes that's one that's a little more likely for someone to like weed whack and get exposed to the sap. So definitely look up wild parsnip and familiarize yourself with that. And then the DEC is also conducting control of kudzu, which is an invasive vine that's currently invading southern areas of New York State and Long Island and New York City. And that's one that we definitely want to stay on top of. So if you see any kudzu vines, feel free to report that as well. Or, you know, any invasive plants that, you know, landowners struggling to deal with, we're happy to provide information and talk you through and identify whatever you're dealing with. Feel free to call the info line. We also have an additional email address you can send general invasive plant inquiries to, and that's just invasiveplants@dec.ny.gov.
Before we go, how important is it for public reporting to DEC's efforts to track and manage not only giant hogweed, but all these invasive species?
Very important. You know, we started this program in 2008 with about 300 plants or 300 sites. And at this point, I think we're up to about 3,000. So definitely very important. But most of those have been acquired through public reports. And I also encourage people, if you're interested in this and interested in sort of reporting and cataloging the locations of invasive plants, to look up New York IMAP invasives. If you do a web search for that, you should be able to find that. And that's a tool that the DEC has partnered with some other agencies to create to help people report different invasive plants. And then that data will be used in turn by the DEC and other organizations to drive management practices.
That's Daniel Waldhorn with New York State Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Lands and Forests, where he specializes in invasive species. There's more information at dec.ny.gov. Daniel, thank you so much for this important information.
Sure thing. Happy year. Have a great day.
You too. Still to come, a century on the water. We'll talk with Joel DeYoung of the Chamber of the Northern Poconos about the events marking Lake Wallenpaupack's 100th anniversary. Wow. And why the celebration is much more than looking back. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, 5 days in Palestine, we go all the way to the West Bank to ask this question: what drives Latino solidarity with Palestinians?
Connection to land has been my compass, especially seeing so many injustices in the world. How land is really at the root of it all.
That's this week on Latino USA. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. Lake Wallenpaupack has been a defining feature of Northeast Pennsylvania for a century, drawing generations of residents and visitors to its shores and helping shape the region's economy and identity. This year, the lake's 100th anniversary is being celebrated, and communities around the lake are having a weekend of special events honoring that history and looking ahead to its future. Joining us now, Joel DeYoung with the Chamber of the Northern Poconos to talk more about the centennial celebration. Joel, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Wow, 100 years of Lake Wallenpaupack. What does the centennial milestone mean for the communities around Northeast Pennsylvania that enjoy that lake?
I know, it's crazy, right? So the big thing is it's a man-made lake, and a lot of people don't realize that, but there was a lot of hardworking men and women that built this lake and made it what it is today. And, you know, we're just all benefiting from that now.
Talk a little bit more about that history for folks who may not know it, how Lake Wallenpaupack has shaped the region over the last 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, it started with Pennsylvania Power and Light. They wanted to produce hydroelectricity, so they decided that the valley of Wilsonville was a good valley to fill. So they started with taking buildings down, clear-cutting trees and that kind of thing. They even relocated a cemetery and decided to build the dam and the dike in Tafton and fill the valley with water and start producing hydroelectric power.
Yeah, and the numbers around this lake are kind of stunning. It is 52 miles of shoreline, a length of 13 miles, a maximum depth of 60 feet, and has a surface area in excess of 5,700 acres. In short, it's huge.
It's massive. I actually just found out the other day it's 52 billion gallons of water to fill the lake,
wow,
roughly.
And it's the largest man-made lake in Pennsylvania, second largest?
It's the second largest. It's the second largest man-made lake and the third largest in the Commonwealth.
Wow. What kinds of events are the centennial celebration including? And what are some of the events that you're most excited about?
Yeah, so we're hosting what is called Wally 100, which is a band on the lake. That's going to be on Saturday from 12 to 4. So we're going to have some live entertainment going on. But also in the morning, there were Big Brothers Big Sisters at the Wallenpaupack Visitor Center is going to do a cornhole tournament. So that should be a pretty good kickoff to Saturday's events. But other than that, one of the biggest things I think is important for people to show up for is Brookfield at the Wallenpaupack Learning Center, which is right by the dam, is doing some historical talks and presentations about the lake. Those are at 1 and 3 p.m. on Saturday. Just kind of a brief, you know, hour-long history talk about certain parts of the lake and that kind of thing.
And that is happening this Saturday. The Lake Wallenpaupack region is a major tourism destination. What impact do you expect this celebration to have on local businesses and the economy as more people come in?
Yeah, obviously the main goal is always heads and beds and that kind of thing, bringing people into our area. We suggested heavily that everybody do their kind of their own events throughout the weekend as well. So there are other things going on. You can find a full list of events on wallenpaupack100.org. But I know there's a lot of local venues that are doing bands and, you know, like the Wallenpaupack Brewing Company, Gresham's Chop House. There's a lot of places around that are doing live entertainment and that sort of thing, just to kind of, you know, get going and spending money during the weekend.
How have local businesses and organizations and volunteers all come together to make this celebration happen for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately for the chamber anyway, it comes down to sponsorships. So we like to thank those guys, Lighthouse Harbor Marina, Milford Animal Hospital, and of course, Brookfield Renewable. They all pitched in a good portion. But there are plenty of other sponsors that we had this year to help out with our event here. To get the, you know, the floating stage out there isn't an easy task and that sort of thing. So all that money goes towards, you know, our events and hopefully back towards our economy.
And again, where can folks find out the full schedule of events and register for any activities like the boat parade, or did that get canceled?
The boat parade, unfortunately, did get canceled, but we will still have the live entertainment, of course. And that's going to be walmhallpack100.org for the full list of events.
All right. That is Joel DeYoung from the Chamber of the Northern Poconos talking about this weekend's celebration of Lake Wallenpaupack celebrating its 100th anniversary. Joel, thanks so much. Have fun.
Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, culture reporter Valerie Manzi sits down with the actress and playwright of the one-woman show Home, a Palestinian woman's pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, opening this weekend at the Franklin Stage Company. Stay with us. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Bella Freud. She's a clothing designer and host of Fashion Neurosis, a conversation podcast about the connection between clothes and identity. It's an unconventional setup where Freud's guests lie on a couch. Her great-grandfather was the legendary psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. A new production opening this weekend at the Franklin Stage Company explores questions of identity, belonging, and what it means to find home. Home, a Palestinian woman's pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, is an autobiographical one-woman play written and performed by actress and playwright Hend Ayoub. The production follows a young woman's journey to reclaim and reimagine a sense of home. Radio Catskill culture reporter Valerie Manzi recently spoke with Hend Ayoub about the deeply personal story behind the play.
Home, A Palestinian Woman's Pursuit of Life, Liberty, and Happiness is being performed this weekend up in Franklin, New York at the Franklin Stage Company. And the playwright and actress is here to tell us all about it. So we're going to welcome Hend Ayoub. Welcome, Hend.
Thank you.
So this is quite a production. I just wanted to know, how long has this been in the works?
It's been in the works for a long time. I wrote it many years ago. And as you know, like, this type of work takes a long time to get to finish the work, get it produced, find a producer, put it all together. So I started many years ago, and then I didn't know what to do with it. So it just sat in my drawer until Wynn Handman, who had a studio and was teaching, a wonderful acting teacher, very well known, who taught a lot of actors like Denzel Washington, Richard Gere, Dustin Hoffman, and all other names. He agreed to let me workshop the play at his studio. So this is how it finally got to move from being just something that you write and sit in your drawer into a production eventually.
And you've had other productions elsewhere in the country.
Yes, I have. So the world premiere was in San Francisco. It was a co-production of San Francisco Playhouse in Z-Space. And then it moved to New York City at 59 E59 Theaters, and it closed last October.
And now you'll be right here in the Catskills with us.
Yes, I'm very excited to share it with more people that are not from big cities. It's really exciting.
And tell us a little bit about this one-woman show.
So it's an autobiographical show about my life. It's a very specific story, yet very universal. People are surprised how universal it is. It's a story that is rarely told anywhere, really, but mainly in the States. It's a story of a Palestinian born and raised in Israel. And what's that like to be a Palestinian who's an Israeli citizen? And trying to find a sense of belonging and a sense of home in a place that really doesn't want you. And it's a journey. My journey starts in Israel, then to the Arab world, and then finally to America. So you'll get to experience what's that like. And I think the log line of the play really describes what the show is about in the best way. It says, in Israel, she's Palestinian. In the Arab world, she's Israeli. And in America, she's an other. And yet, with all this specific information, it's still very universal. People can relate to a lot of stories and aspects of the story, and also, surprisingly, very funny, because people are not expecting to laugh when they hear a story about Palestinians. I want to encourage people to come and see the show, to laugh and learn something new.
Tell us a little about James Ard, the sound director, who is described here as a noisemaker.
James Ard is a great sound designer. I had a great time working with him and finding, you know, the little sound cues that make the experience of and brings the story to life. And the director, Carrie Perloff, who's a wonderful director that I was lucky enough to work with her for the first time at Arena Stage in a production of 1,000 Splendid Suns. And I told her about the play because I was looking for a director. And I did a reading for her the day we closed the show, and she loved it. So we started working together, and it's been a long journey with Carrie. We started working on Zoom during COVID. And then we workshopped the play in San Francisco at San Francisco Playhouse. And then we got another workshop. And then we moved to D.C. with a workshop production that Ari Roth gave us with Voices Festival Production. And finally, we got to premiere it at San Francisco Playhouse and also in New York. So Carrie really brought a lot of new things and really helped shape it and develop it and help me a lot. And she's a wonderful director and a person.
Well, it is a collaboration for sure.
Yes.
Now, I see here you have quite a few theater credits as well as television credits as well as film credits.
Yes. You know, I've been working. I'm auditioning mainly, you know, actors mainly audition. That's mm-hmm. my work. And in between, we get to book work. It's been great. You know, I left Israel because I couldn't get any work being Arab. You know, there's very limited options for us. And they're mainly terrorists and bad people. Unfortunately, I came to America and found out that it's the same thing. But at least you'll get a little bit more opportunities and a little bit more human stories. I'm hoping there would be more. But, you know, my play is my way of showing a different way than Americans. You know, they hear Palestinians or they hear Arabs, and you're watching TV and film all the time, and subconsciously that's what they're putting in your mind, that they're all villains. And my play finally gives me the opportunity to tell a human story with love and humor and share my family and all the experiences that I went through. I chose this in a much better way, in a great way, in a human way that you can relate to. And at the end of the play, you really, like, even though the story is so different than what you know, you learn a lot of new things that most Americans don't know about Palestinians, or specifically Palestinians living in Israel. At the end, you learn that we're all human and we all have so much in common than not.
Well, yes, that's the final truth after all is said and done.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us your website so folks can find out more about you and your work?
Sure. It's hindayoub.com. My name is Hind. It's H-E-N-D. My last name is Ayoub, A-Y-O-U-B, .com.
Okay. And folks can go to Franklin Stage Company for more information about what's going on up there. And just to make you aware, this weekend, the Friday and Saturday shows are at 7:30 and the Sunday is at 5. So enjoy your foray here into the Catskills.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
And before we go, just enough time to tell you about another great event coming up this weekend in the area. Arrowhead Ranch in Parksville hosting another live music community event on Saturday. And here to tell us more are Michael Moss of Jaketown Road and Marty Weinbaum of Grateful Talent, the music promoter for Arrowhead Ranch. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
You guys have had a busy summer. Tell us more about this Arrowhead Ranch revival scheduled for Saturday.
Well, hey, everybody. We're having a big fest this Saturday. Gates open at 12. And we're going to start the day off with a band from Long Island honoring Jerry Garcia. So they're going to be doing the music of Jerry Garcia at 1 o'clock with a full band, female vocalist. So if you're a big fan of Jerry Garcia, whose birthday is coming up, I believe, on August 1st, you won't want to miss this. And then following this band, they're called Jerry Jive out of Long Island, is our own Johnny Jules and his band. He's going to be playing music of the Grateful Dead, the band, New Riders of the Purple Sage, and a lot of Americana from the 60s and 70s. And what's important about this event is that you can bring your lawn chairs, you can feel at home. We want the local people to come out and be supportive of this event, because if we don't have the locals helping out in this event, as far as coming to the shows, we really can't put these shows on. So we need everybody to come out. And I think Marty's going to talk about the other stuff.
Yeah, Marty, tell us about the other stuff.
Yeah, sure. We have a great band called Finally Balanced. They're an original band from Long Island with a history dating back to the old days of Arrowhead Ranch, when they performed with good old Buddy Cage. They are reforming for this special occasion and will feature a guest poet filling in for the late Billy Capozzi, who fronted the band originally. Then we have local talent out of Woodstock, Misty Mountain Ramblers. That's with Kenny Schneidman and Denise Parent. Big musicians in the Woodstock community. And then, of course, our number one headliner is Creamery Station, who has played many times over at Arrowhead Ranch, and we love those guys.
And you're talking about community and support, and you're looking for folks to support a little bit.
Yeah, so, we're reaching out to the businesses in the area. We'd love people to be involved and help sponsor our events. So if you have a business, Arrowhead Ranch is a 501c3 nonprofit. So all your sponsorship money is 100% tax deductible. So if you're interested, please reach out to Arrowhead Ranch. You can reach them at arrowheadranch.org, and Rose Barnett, our proprietor, will be able to help you out with that.
And again, the Arrowhead Ranch Revival is at the Arrowhead Ranch and Retreat in Parksville on Saturday. More information, ticket information at arrowheadranch.org.
Arrowheadranch.org. You can also go to Facebook, to the Grateful Talent Facebook page. Please come, like, and share. I've posted many, many posts for all the shows we're doing. We also have a big show on August 1st with Chris Jacobs and the Wolfpack. And the Wolfpack is the strings and horn section for Bob Weir's band. And then, of course, we have the inimitable Stanley Jordan on August 15th on Woodstock weekend doing a Dead set and Jimi Hendrix set.
August 1st is Jerry Garcia's birthday. All right, Michael Moss of Jaketown Road and Marty Weinbaum of Grateful Talent, the music promoter for Arrowhead Ranch. More information at arrowheadranch.org. Thank you guys so much. Have a great concert.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Tim.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
FF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain. We are Radio Catskill.